You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. This podcast is now more than 5 years old. In that time, the global open banking community has grown enormously. Some form of movement or initiative has now sprung up in over 90 countries. While different places approach open banking in different ways, the core idea is now well understood. Common shared standards for the secure exchange of financial data based on people's consent. In my time as Mr. Open Banking, I have had the pleasure of speaking with experts and innovators from many of these places. Although global, the community is surprisingly small, with many of us driven by the same goals and passions. And as with any community, some relationships remain casual, while others become stronger. Some, if you're lucky, even lead to genuine friendships. In this very special episode of Mr. Open Banking, recorded live in Las Vegas at last year's Money 2020, I sit down with three people who I am proud to call my friends. Between them, our three guests have been instrumental to driving open banking in their respective regions, namely the US, the UK, and Canada. They have also, to varying degrees, encountered all three pillars of open banking, namely data sharing, payments, and digital ID. A conversation with all three of them at the same table was bound to be filled with gems. So, without further ado, we hope you enjoy this episode of Mr. Open Banking Live. You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the evolution of open banking around the world. I'm your host, A.L. Savan, broadcasting live from the Moneypot exhibit at the world's premier fintech event, Money 2020. For this session, I'm joined by three very special guests who, between them, have been instrumental in bringing open banking to several different places in several different ways, in some cases via related technology spheres like payments or digital ID. Beyond being experts in their respective fields, I'm also exceedingly proud to call all of them my friends. They also all know each other quite well, which will hopefully lead to a frank and open conversation. Don Cardinal is the managing director at the Financial Data Exchange, the leading U.S. open banking standards body. Michelle Bayo is the founder of Finovator, a specialized fintech advisory, and the board chair at Open Finance Network Canada. And David Birch is an author, advisor, and international speaker on the subject of digital identity and digital money. Let's get started. It's a pleasure to have three such experienced guests to speak to, in no small part because your experiences are so different from each other. Why don't we start by having each of you briefly explain what you do, your relationship to open banking, and how you've been part of its emergence in your respective regions.
Sure, I'm happy to kick things off. So I'm Dave Birch. I'm, as you said, an author, advisor, and commentator on digital finance. I'm global ambassador for Consult Hyperion, which is a specialist electronic transactions consultancy, and our clients include Open Banking UK and Pay UK. And the UK experience, I think, is illustrative because we went very early into open banking. From a slightly different position. In the UK, it was driven by the Competition and Markets Authority, who were very upset with the lack of competition between the biggest banks. And so we came at it very much from that competition perspective. It only applied to the very biggest banks, and they were given a very You could say they were given a very tough time, and basically they were told they had to do it, and that was the end of the story. I think in retrospect, and I'm not saying this just like total wisdom of hindsight, we made a lot of mistakes. And I think if you look at other jurisdictions, which I'm sure we'll discuss in a moment, you can see how people have taken a slightly different approach, which has worked out slightly better. So I'm not saying ours is like the template that we should be following. But what I will say is, in terms of the goals of it, I think the competition goal hasn't been met particularly, because the competition goal was stated in very narrow terms in terms of account switching between the major banks. Like, in other words, they were using account switching as the barometer of whether the competition was going up or down. I personally think that was a very bad measure in retrospect. It didn't really do anything. But in terms of bringing innovation into the space, and I personally am an investor in a small company that's building on top of open banking in this space, I think it's gone in really interesting directions. And a lot of those actually aren't anything to do with core banking. It's using banking data to provide better services in other sectors. So yeah, we went first, we made a bunch of mistakes, but I think our use cases are useful.
You had the courage the first draft of the UK, and you proved it could be done with large amounts of data. And there were a lot of things and decisions that were made early on that are reflected around the world. So, you know, for example, everyone's using REST APIs, everyone's using JSON, I think an OAuth variance for authentication. So there are a lot of things echoed around the world. So I wouldn't be too hard on it. Now, in the States, I'm Don Cardo, Managing Director of Financial Data Exchange. Sorry, I jumped right in there. I retired from banking about 6 years ago to lead a market-led way of doing open finance, the idea being, what does the customer want? What data are we seeing flowing out through the firewalls? What's a better way than screen scraping with credentials? And then what's the customer demanding with their thumbs? They used to vote with their feet, now they vote with their thumbs. And then that's what we build. And so we started with 22 member organizations, about 2 million users benefiting on these APIs. We're now over 200 organizations, roughly 94 million consumers, unique consumers benefiting from this, and several billion transactions a day. But we went straight into open finance. The idea is, what does a customer want? Well, everything that was being scraped had to be accounted for in the spec. And so it was very much of, what problem are we trying to solve? And so we let the customer tell us what to solve. And I have these wonderful members that if you give them, talented engineer, a stack of Legos or Tinker Toys or whatever, they will build wonderful things, which is why we have corporate and treasury and payroll and fraud reporting and tax and a variety of other things that the markets demanded, but no one told us to build.
So much to jump in on. Michelle Bayo, CEO and founder of Finovator, as AL said, also the president of the Open Finance Network. My journey in open banking actually started when I was working for a blockchain company focused on digital identity, consent on blockchain, back in 2018. And as I started to learn externally about what was happening in the UK, I was inspired by the concept of data ownership. To me, it's a human data right. I want this to be something that goes beyond open banking to open finance to open economy, because I truly feel the need to be able to control my data, because that is not something we could do. Even if you're savvy, tech savvy, and try and ensure that you don't use apps that are, you know, taking all of your data and utilizing it in ways that you're unaware of, there's no way to delete my data. And I live in Canada, so there's currently still no way for me to delete my data, but I look forward to the future where across multi-intersections, I'm able to do so based on an open banking ecosystem. And I became the president of the Open Finance Network after being a board member for 2.5 years alongside AL. So very passion project driven in Canada as we try and look beyond. Canada's kind of behind in multitude of ways that we could get into, from real-time rail to open banking to digital identity. But we do have, usually human rights is a core infrastructure in Canada. So if I look at it from a human data right perspective, that's what I'm trying to push forward on. But from a Finovator, I started my company 5 years ago, largely because I won Money 2020 Rise Up, where they picked 30 women out of 500 around the world back in 2019. And I was one of those lucky women. And when I found out I won and I was still at that blockchain company, I started Finovator 24 hours later so I could announce that I was the CEO of Finovator, and I was going to take everything I've learned from digital identity. I was in telco for 6 years. I was in online shopping affiliate marketing for 3. So I was just trying to take all of that knowledge. Everything I've touched is touching the future of finance. So Finovator is a future of finance consultancy.
Here in the U.S., just a few days ago, on October 22nd, 2024, the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, released their final open banking rule based on Section 1033 of the Consumer Protection Act, known as Dodd-Frank. Although Don is likely more familiar with the rule than Michelle and David, I invite each of you to share your perspectives on what the rule says and what makes it unique or not compared to other open banking rules around the world.
So it's about 600 plus, or nearly 600 pages. There's still a lot to go in. And when you lead a market-driven consortium of over 200 organizations, we still are conferring over what it is and what it means to our membership, from the bigs to the smalls, from the providers and the recipients and service and technology companies. So we're still noodling over that before we come out and say anything publicly on it. There's a lot to go over and a lot to get consensus on. So it takes a while to herd a lot of cats, but stay tuned, there will be more.
I see so much. Like, 600 pages is a lot to try and ingest, and I could admit I have not read all 600 pages, but there's been some really great summaries put out, and ingesting what I've seen, for me, I see Australia as a beacon in the sense of their consumer data rights, because it was a data ownership, not a data portability concept, and that looks like that's something that's coming out of the US, that it's more of a data ownership than data portability. Also, the fact that payments is included to get to a pay-by-bank play, where that is not considered currently in Canada, and was a later on addition in many other countries. So it's really interesting to see that we're going to get right into the meat of what this could be GDP growth wise, competition wise, by getting into pay by bank. And I think having a phased approach from a largest bank to smaller bank perspective, going from April 1st, 2026 of the larger banks, followed in for basically a year. Every year there's a different tier of banks bringing their infrastructure into the fold all the way up to 2030. So it's giving that path to allow people to take their time to get in, but also maybe credit unions jumping in early if they want to take advantage. So I think there's so much to dig in on, but those are 3 points.
We have a lot of credit unions and credit union service organizations as members. We have the whole range of early adopters to fast followers to, again, some folks who are secondary followers. And so shout outs to Boeing employees, Credit Union of Colorado, PSCU, even UW Credit Union. And so we have a lot of community institutions who are active in the space. And if you will borrow a metaphor, punch way above their weight.
I'm annoyed by Michelle, actually, because she just said pretty much everything I was going to say, because maybe we put it into the same ChatGPT and told us the same. I'm joking, she didn't put it into ChatGPT. I think two things have stood out for me. You're right about the rights-based approach, and actually we've discussed that before. I think the way that Australia changed the way people think about that was really interesting, and I think it's affected a lot of people's thinking, and I think you see that reflected in 1033, and I personally agree with that. I'm very supportive of that. I think one of the big mistakes we made was we didn't have a staged implementation. I think that also really helps. We just said, you know, the big banks have to do it on this day. And I think in retrospect, it might have been better to say, okay, the top four banks do it on this day, and then a bit later on the next one, a bit later. And you could also stage it by functionality as well, because I think one of the interesting lessons, if you're looking around the world, places like Hong Kong, Brazil, places like that, they also didn't do the whole thing on day one. They went with what we think of as read first and then read write later on. So I think staged approach is good. That's a different thing. But the heart of it is a very different view from the sort of the UK competition base, which, as Michelle said, is more about fundamental data rights. And I think in the long run, that is actually the better way to organize it.
Both Michelle and David brought up this concept of data rights. So let's go there. While it's commonly called Section 1033, the CFPB called their rule Personal Financial Data Rights. They didn't call it a payments directive, like you saw in Europe. They didn't call it a competition order, like you saw in the UK, although competition is most certainly a priority. Similar to Australia, they called it a data right. What is the significance of that decision?
In terms of the long-term evolution of what you might think of as the sort of post-industrial, online, whatever you call it, economy, I've bored people to tears saying this for many years. It's identity that becomes the core resource. That's the important thing about you. And you can easily do the mental experiment to understand this. If, like, some sort of mysterious comet came from outer space and just wiped out all of the money in your bank account, you could survive. You could go and get a loan. You could get by if your money vanishes. You can. But if a mysterious comet came and took away your identity, you can't reboot. Like, you go to the bank, like, my credit card doesn't work, and they'd be like, who are you? That doesn't... So it's clear that identity is the key resource. Now, the data about you then becomes this incredibly important commodity. And we already see the abuse of that on an absolutely industrial scale, manifesting itself not only in fraud and the general... You know, you don't have to be paranoid about surveillance capitalism to think maybe that's not the best way of doing things. If you had what you might think of as an unrestricted, absolute data right, in other words, if you, the individual, could do whatever you wanted with your data, that would be a bad outcome too. Because if you did that, people would give their data away for a Snickers bar. As an industry, we've got to be much more responsible to protect and support people in using and exploiting that data right. So I'm not a maximalist who thinks everybody should be given their data and can do whatever they want with it. And I don't think that's what this is saying. But what it is saying is institutions have to respond when people legitimately want to share their data with third parties. And those third parties aren't just anybody who shows up on Reddit. I mean, it's people who are licensed and regulated.
I think it opens the door to the concept of open data. If you call it a data right, then that data right is assumed to be financed today. But as you see, Australia is one of the only markets who've made a path out to a bigger, wider net to go from open banking to open finance to open energy to open telco to open data. Then it becomes the consumer owns this data, and we're going to address this use case in banking because they have the most data on the consumer move forward to get them to open data, which is enabling them to use their data by consent to the right parties for the right use case without it just being siphoned from them. It's giving control that one day they might be able to say, oh, I no longer want to work with this party, delete my data. Oh, well, there needs to be a path to delete that data, meaning they had to have had track of my consent and therefore allow me to delete it going forward.
I think utilities is a really interesting and easy example to use because all the time I get these emails because like, you know, we could save you this on your gas or that on your electricity or with this on your water. Like, I have no clue. I'm a normal person. I can't possibly do those calculations in my... But actually, it's trivial stuff for a bot to do. Like, if I can give a bot access to those accounts, in nanoseconds, it could tell me you're with the wrong energy company or you should change the water to this plan or you should be on electricity plan B, not plan A, stuff like... Those things are immediate and tangible benefits to consumers. It isn't just all about banking, I agree, but banking is crucial.
Yeah, that's why we jumped into open finance from the start, because we looked at the data that was flowing out and said, well, it's more than just current accounts, checking and saving, credit cards, it's mortgages, auto loans, investments, pensions, and all the other things we built into it. So we also had to, because we're our market led, but to your point, the consumers want a lot of things. Now, it's interesting, we have folks in three jurisdictions here, but globally, open finance is a really small community. And we all look at each other's homework. If you look at our UX, it looks a lot like the user experience flows from Australia, which is heavily influenced by the UX version 1 from the UK. And we all look at each other and say, what are you doing? What's that? How's that work? And that's good, though, that we're all informed by things. You saw that represented when Brazil did their implementation, Saudi did their implementation. The later you go, the more learning you can look from. So again, we still stay plugged in. So again, I think we will expand into other data types because there's consumer demand, which is why those data types I mentioned earlier, because they all work. Now we're going to see ancillary things that are tangential. Payroll data, we have a payroll task force, we have a fraud reporting task force, because they're tangential to the other things. And you're going to see this slow amorphous growth because the customers are demanding it.
Can I just make one point about the open finance? Because Don's absolutely right about this. One of the lessons we learned very early on, we had a thing, what we call, I still call it the midterm review, even though it was years ago now. But after the first couple of years of open banking, there were a couple of detailed reviews of the technology and the consumer impact. And on the consumer impact side, I remember very clearly the goal of delivering actual improved financial health to consumers, which we all share. You can't do that just with banking data. If I really want to improve your financial health, I need to know your mortgage, I need to know your credit cards, I need to know your retirement. So open finance is the prerequisite to financial health, not just open banking. Don's spot on.
Yeah, if you wanted to look at marginalized communities, unbanked, underbanked, thin file, no file, you've got to get them from net spender to net saver, to net investor. That's the same formula planet-wide for thousands of years.
Yeah.
It's all well and good to talk about open data in the context of things like utilities, healthcare, and so on. But there's a Rubicon that hasn't been crossed yet. Shortly following the original announcement of the Section 1033 rule late last year, the CFPB also announced proposed measures to regulate big tech. It doesn't take much of a leap to see personal financial data rights combining with big tech regulation leading to a generalized data right, as you've discussed, but one that applies to the data held by the big tech companies. Is that where this is all headed?
I'm more of a maximalist, so I would say more strongly than that. I'm saying it's where we should be headed. I think the debate about regulating big tech is, in some ways, rather outdated and simplistic. I see these calls for people saying, well, the only way for you have to break up Google or you have to break up YouTube or whatever. That's like a very kind of 20th century solution to a 19th century problem of market dominance. I think open banking provides a different template. If you want to have an impact, to have a more competitive environment, you don't need to break Google up. You need to open them up. And so when new I could come up with the most brilliant new social network, the most brilliant new travel management program, and it wouldn't matter because I can't get access to the data. If things, stupid, trivial things like, I'm sick to death of Twitter, I'm going to go to some other thing. I want to take all my friends with me. You can't even, it's like if you want real competition, breaking those companies up is a ridiculous, like that belongs to railroads and steel and stuff like that. The point about data is much more that, like, if you really want to make more competitive industries, then I think open finance is a template that can be applied to those other industries. I should be allowed to go to another social network and say, you can have permission to look at my Facebook graph or whatever. So I put it much more strongly. I think it's what we should be doing.
I think it's like layering into the fact that if Google's using my data for some other platform that they already own that I also utilize, I want to be the part of the consent that allows that data to be utilized. I want them to have that regulatory oversight so that I delete my history, I don't track my history on anything that I facilitate as I'm trying not to create the biggest data record in the world. And I literally read my kids' T's and C's on every app on their phone because I also know that they're being tracked and that there's data being utilized. I think Apple and Google and anybody who has a phone should have a mandate that I get to choose my privacy policy, and then every app that breaks that privacy policy alerts me before I download. I shouldn't have to read the T's and C's. I should be able to say, oh, this is how comfortable I am with sharing my data. Give me every app. Oh, there's no apps. Maybe I'll expand a little, but I want an overarching. I don't want to read anybody else's T's and C's on the apps I download for my kids or for myself. I want these providers to protect me at the layer that I want to live. I don't want free apps. I want to pay for ChatGPT so that I at least know that I have some control and I don't let it feed the machine. I think people need to understand if you're going to use infrastructure, read it so that you maybe need to pay level one or level two so that you have more data rights. You don't have any data rights if it's free. You have to know you are the product. So I think it's getting to that mentality of if they were regulated to ensure I had, this is my level of data sharing, then amazing. Then I don't have to think about it to the same degree.
I think we as an industry have to make those protections part of the infrastructure. You don't, I mean, it's a mistake, but like when you buy a car, they don't give you here's some interesting things you could read about seatbelts. We suggest like educate yourself about crashes. You don't do that. It's just like that's the infrastructure to protect people. And we don't yet have that in this space. And I think it's not that hard to imagine how that might work.
Well, we do have some of that. I mean, with data standards and guidelines and common taxonomies, I think we allow to do that. We think about the car example. You have that sticker that says, here's the features, here's the gas mileage, here's how it complies with the environmental EPA laws. And so we have a lot of that, but you need a common taxonomy or standardization of the elements. And from there, you can build common elements. And then you further empower the consumer who's used to seeing I know what these Legos look like. Okay, I know how they work. You don't have to tell a three-year-old how to build with Legos. They understand natively.
Let's try and zoom out, look at the bigger picture. Ultimately, the consent-driven sharing of data, whether that's financial data or open data is really only one pillar of a complete
open banking or open data environment.
To complete the picture, you have to have payments so that money can be moved around, and digital ID so that transactions and consents can be properly verified. What is the role of these other two pillars, and what is their relationship to open data at large? Let's start with payments. What do you see happening in the payment space around the world?
Well, I think you have to look at PIPS, right? Like, first of all, real-time rail is in 88 countries. It's just come to the US. It's about to come to Canada someday in the near future, maybe a couple of years from now. And I think what you have to realize is the role of real-time rail is instant payments, but you need digital identity to have good instant payments. But I think when you look at PICS and you look at them creating that real-time payment system in a country that was underserved, underbanked, and had a lot of cash in its ecosystem, and the fact that they're sitting at something like 2 billion transactions a month, and they're in, what, year three?
For those who don't know, PICS is the real-time rail introduced to great success by Brazil.
Yeah, so they're at 150 million users in 2023, and they're 3 years in. So that mass success from a push into the market. And they've done it with a digital identity play in that same respect, but I know that's not part of the question, but that you're looking at payments from a real-time rail, from an instant pay-by-bank. It's so crucial to take a market that is underserved and underbanked and bring them into digitization of the future. And it helps GDP at the same time, because there's a lot of off-the-record payments that are now on the record, but people are happy to have had access to it, because before in Brazil, carrying cash is not a safe action to have. So if you're able as a merchant to take in digitized QR-based payment infrastructure, and the person across from you has a digital identity with a QR-based payment infrastructure, and no one's exchanging cash, you can't really steal this money. It's going directly to their core bank. So I think that there's a lot of innovation coming from real-time rail in tangential path of open banking digital identity.
Well, I think it illustrates a better way of... So it goes back to that competition point again. So, and I'll use Australia as the example, because we were talking about it earlier on. So merchants in Australia are upset about the cost of payments. They go to complain to the government. The government says, okay, we're going to limit interchange fees. I mean, depending on who you read, like, not a lot of that gets passed back to consumers. The merchants keep a lot of that, which is what I would do if I was merchants. And you really get nowhere. If you want to reduce costs, you need more competition, not more regulation. And what in places like Brazil is, once you provide these open interfaces that people can build on, you provide the real-time rails for people to communicate, you don't need to regulate, because you get the competition. You would think that would be the American way of these things. It's like, if you want to improve the situation, you do it by increasing competition. And this fits very nicely in that space. To the point about digital identity, which I think is actually, I mean, and that's one of the key lessons you could learn from us, because we didn't do anything about digital identity. So you end up with everybody having to build their own directories and things, whatever. I think that which is not a bad thing, because I can see out the corner of my eye Brendan from Consensus, who's built a very successful company managing those identities and that. So it wasn't bad for everybody. But as a lesson to learn from us, I think we did it slightly the wrong way. It would have been better to have done something about identity and the consent management.
I'm going to reel you in a bit, David. We will get to digital ID.
Okay. But I would hate to think we went past that.
I wanted to verify a quote. I think I remember you penning a quote, say, payments is just identity plus bookkeeping.
Yeah, I was a bit. But it's true. If you know who everybody in a transaction is, then managing the ledger is really not that complicated, and it shouldn't be that expensive. So you can't disentangle the two.
Instead of jumping ahead, tell us about M-Pesa. You were involved in building one of the most unique payment schemes in the world.
Yeah, it's true, because Casal Hyperion did the original feasibility study for M-Pesa all those years ago. Yeah, one of my favorite presentations, I've got it on my laptop, is the PowerPoint from when there were 7 agents and like 1,000 users of that sort of thing. But I think that kind of illustrates the point, which is, if you build something, and of course this is person to person, I mean, it's to your point with PICS, if you build something person to person that works and is for the market it's intended for and is easy for everyone to use, you don't have to think of all the applications yourself. People come in and they automatically pull it into these. I'll give you one very simple example, which I remember very well, which was you say about carrying cash in Brazil, the same was true in Kenya. So you create something which is for internal remittance and you think the money is going to be sent to remote. And then you look in the logs and money being loaded onto phones on one side of the city and then being cashed out an hour later on the other side of the city because carrying the cash on the bus was too dangerous. So you didn't predict that was coming. The tea plantations, I think, is another good example where it was cheaper, basically, to subsidize the workers to get phones than it was to carry on counting out cash into little envelopes at the end of the week. And if you build something that actually works in this way, now, of course, in that example, you've got the SIM card, you've got the mobile phone number, and for transactions up to us, that's an adequate proxy for transactions to a certain level, which actually, to what Michelle was saying earlier on, illustrates another book, which is tangential to what we're discussing in the podcast. But actually, a few years ago, if the telcos had ever got their act together and sorted themselves out properly about this, the telcos could have provided that platform. And they never got themselves organized to do it properly.
Don, when the CFPB released the final version of their rule, they doubled down on the importance of the pay-by-bank use case. Although the regulation did not go to the point of including payment initiation explicitly, clearly they highlighted the increase of competition in the payment space as being a goal. Your thoughts?
Well, I'll take a more macro view. I think the extent that you have common and hygienic and then standardized information of any type, it's going to allow people to have, one, lower barriers to entry and even the table stakes for all players. Two, it facilitates competition. And I'll give you an example. I just bought a gaming keyboard for my kid. None of the companies compete on the USB end of the things. They all compete on the part that lights up and does whatever. And so I think the extent that we facilitate competition, I think that's an important piece. But beyond that, I'll leave it to all the really smart people out here on the floor to come up with the new bells and whistles.
All right, David. Let's get to the thing that you really want to talk about, digital ID. As that third pillar, what is happening in the often politicized world of digital identity?
Well, what's happening is nothing, which is why fraud is completely out of control and nobody knows who anybody is and the internet is a complete mess. What should happen when we start thinking about open banking? I'm old school, so personally I would prefer if the banks would get together and sort this out themselves. I'd prefer that they did that. But the reason why it's such a priority in this space, is, which I think a lot of people in the audience won't really have thought about, is because the era of AI is on us. And a very good friend of mine, a guy called Mike Kelly, who wrote the VRP standards for the UK open banking, wrote a little ChatGPT plugin called BankGPT, which used the UK open banking API standards. So that his AI could talk through the API to his bank. And it really wasn't that complicated. And a lot of the things people do with open banking are actually not that interesting. Like, we're human beings, we have much more interesting things to do with our time. So one of the angles on open banking that I think is underthought about in strategic terms is quite who is going to be using these APIs. Because when we started open banking, the idea that you would have AIs accessing those and doing payments and making decisions was never even thought about, and now it's right on us. And I'm using that to illustrate a particular point about digital identity, which is we think about digital identity when we're just talking about it. You think about the identity of people. That's one little part of it. In this online world that we're talking about, this open finance infrastructure is there to support people, yes, companies. The identity of companies is very problematic, and in fact, even more complicated than the identity of people. Things like the identity of your car. Has the gas station know that it's your car? How do they know that it's got your permission to do these kind of things? AIs and so on. Now, if we're going to revolutionize what's going on in this space, we have to start thinking forward. So in my view, digital identity is just like a big problem right now because we don't have it. It's also fundamental infrastructure for going forward in the future. And there's progress. There's things like mobile driving license, and it's like there's nothing else. But we're not where we should be, are we, Don?
I mean, state of Colorado's got a mobile driver's license now, and there's a few other pilot, but I want to go Professor Dawn on you just a little bit. If you think about that identity, it's a series of assertions. I am David Birch. This David Birch is indeed a world-renowned expert, and the carbon based life form sitting here is indeed David. So when you look at some of the assertions, Open Finance allows you to, for example, connect to your Barclays account and determine by preponderance of signals that beneficial access, the account tenure, that it's likely owned by a synthetic that was made 15 minutes ago, based on the behaviors, that it does indeed correspond to who you are. So there's strong EKYC and identity signals within Open Finance data that are useful as we build that identity, which again is a preponderance of signals that assertions are more likely than not true or false.
I think it also provides a very simple solution to a lot of those things. If I go to log into, I don't know, some new thing, I'm logging into some hotel or something or whatever, the idea that I could just be bounced to my bank, log in at the bank, and the bank has sent back those assertions, so now the hotel knows, well, apart from anything else, the hotel would know I'm a real person, which it doesn't know at the beginning. That's a very different way of doing things, but it's a much more efficient way of doing things. And your point, Michelle, about the infrastructural level, I could show you on my phone right now. I have a message from my utility company, which said there's some kind of problem with my smart meter, and can I click on this link and go and read it and whatever. I think I'm quite a smart person. I understand about this. I have no way of knowing whether that really came from the utility. No way of knowing. Number doesn't mean anything to me. I go and look the number up. It doesn't exist. It's because it's a short code. I'm a smart guy, and I cannot figure out if that came from the utility company. It shouldn't happen in this way. Like, I'm not giving permission to access my bank account. Like, I don't know it really came from them. It should, like, show up in green if it really did come from the utility company, or red if it didn't.
You know? I don't think you're wrong. Like, I think there's something, A, about them having, like, a logo, like, certified open banking provider on everything that has been validated into a system. So you're not being duped. But I think back to your hotel concept on digital identity. After the Marriott got breached for 7 million records, right? I was one of them, I guess, 5 years ago when I was back at the digital identity organization. And I went to check in Vegas, and they made me, or they were trying to make me, to scan my passport to walk into the hotel. And I wouldn't do it. I'm like, you can't hold my passport. You don't know how to hold my identity. I'm happy to show it to you. Your manager can look at it. Anyone here can look at it, but you don't get a record of my passport because I don't trust you, because you have not proven as a hotel that you know how to hold my data record, nor should you have to. I should be able to QR code myself in here and prove that I am who I say I am without actually handing you any of my data. Like triple blind infrastructure of validation.
But this is where open banking provides a very simple step forward in this space. If you look at what people like One Idea are doing in the UK, this idea that you can use open banking to do things which aren't payments and financial transactions, but these other important things, like just proving you're an actual person, these are all real benefits of the technology infrastructure. And I think people think about 1033, and it's new, but they think about it in slightly narrow terms about access to money and transact. But actually, you know, bank accounts, to your point about signals, that tells you a lot more.
And don't just think about banks, any trusted source, whether it be a payment provider or telco. And that's the beauty of it. Once we've built this common taxonomy and this common set of building blocks, again, the market will do amazing things with them. It's more fun to give a bunch of six-year-olds a big bucket of Legos and sit back and watch them build than to give them, here's a blueprint, here's what I want you to build. That's important.
I appreciate that all three of you are bullish on the value of digital ID, but I used the word politicized in my question. Dawn, ostensibly, you are the U.S. representative at the table. Especially here in the United States, when somebody says federal digital identity, a lot of folks lose their minds. Why, and is there any way to get over that?
There's been a lot of work done in Better ID Coalition and through Identiverse and some other groups to try to get around that. I think culturally, it's a matter, in my personal opinion, not speaking for FDX or anyone else, is just culturally we have such an independent streak. I think the idea of something like that in the hands of a central authority, I think, is very difficult to swallow, given the OMB breach not that long ago to bring up. And so I don't know that we're necessarily going to get there. Now, there have been several attempts to try to replace Social Security number as a unique identifier. And I think we're going to have to come to some sort of hybrid system. But that's just me talking to the identity geeks and what would we need? What could we do? I think common rails and trusted sources and signals and metadata about it, I think will be important as we suss those signals in real time. But there's a range, everything from a government to a self-sovereign. And I think what'll happen is somewhere in between, depending on the context. I know it's a mushy answer, but that's probably where it's going to wind up.
It's not just the U.S. I think it's certainly an Anglosphere problem. So it's the same in the U.K., it's the same in Canada, the same in Australia. And I think, I mean, here, people do, they have some more extreme views about this. I said something in passing, I don't want to say the event because it'll give, but I said something in passing about digital identity. And like the guy said, I suppose you want to put a chip in my head. And I'm like, well, first of all, you're not worth chipping, by the way. And those chips cost 40 cents. So they're not even worth. And actually, we don't have to because Bill Gates already injected the chips in you with the vaccine. And as Robert Kennedy pointed out, they get transmitted back through the 5G towers to the... You tell people this. I mean, first of all, you stop calling it digital identity. You should start calling
check his water bottle.
You should start calling it the anti-migration comfort blanket. Or so. Stop calling it digital identity would be part of the...
Well, I think that there's some
but
advantages.
But we don't want a national ID card in the UK or in the US or anywhere else. You made the point. It's not about the identity. It's about the credentials. Mm. The scheme we need is the scheme that allows me to prove that I'm entitled to do whatever it is I'm trying to do, not who I... We ask people who they are as the proxy to get access to the credential we actually want. If you get the credential, you don't need the identity, and that's the infrastructure we should be building.
And I don't think you're wrong. Signals are the core, right? So there's companies that do give signals that validate that you've had your phone for X amount of years, that you haven't swapped your SIM, that you are in possession of your phone in the IP of the country that you're sitting in.
You see what Prove are doing, like, to...
So I was alluding to Prove, but there's many companies that are doing those signals, but then you look at, like, Brazil having an identity, Anpix, and open banking, magic, implementation, growth. You look at Sweden, you look at them having bank ID, and that bank ID being with 90% of all adult Swedish citizens. And then you look at them doing Swish, and that fact of allowing them for payment infrastructure, and the fact that they've implemented PSD2, and they've got this magic infrastructure of having all three. The stool has all three legs, and therefore they're standing quite strong in their path to Klarna kicking and growing globally, and so on.
And to Don's point, that's not a government ID. That's the banks getting together and saying, we're going to have a common standard and everybody can use it, and people build amazing stuff on top of it.
The goal, of course, is to bring these three pillars together: data sharing, real-time payments, and digital identity. As the U.S. begins building out its own version of open banking as a precursor to open data, what can they learn from other regions who have gone down the road of integrating all three of these pillars? Has anyone gotten it right yet, or is it still early days?
I mean, I would say we can learn a lot. I'm putting my American hat on here, which I'm not. Although I'm married to one, so that probably counts, you know. What we can learn about this actually is important, but they're not templates. So we can look at what's been going on in Brazil. We can look at what's been going on in India. We can learn a lot from those, but I don't think they're templates for the U.S. environment. The U.S. doesn't want a universal identifier, to your point.
We're not going to have Aadhaar here.
We're not.
Ironically, you can't have UPI without Aadhaar.
But we could have an alternative way of credentials-based and so on. So that's why I said we can learn from those things, but they're not templates for the U.S. What I would say about the U.S., I think, and I can say this as an outsider, is, and people think it's a bit of a stereotype about U.S. entrepreneurialism or whatever, but it's basically true. If you look at just the raw figures on the U.S. economy and productivity and growth or whatever, if we put this platform in place for people, I have absolutely no doubt people will build amazing stuff on top of it. So it's not just about competition with banks, and I mean, this is an important part of it. It's about infrastructure for the next generation economy. It's about growth and GDP. I mean, it's really an important part, what people call DPI, digital public infrastructure. It's really an important part of what the US should be building right now, just as important as, I mean, although they build any, but roads and dams and bridges and things.
Well, I feel like you hit on the most important point. When I look at open banking, the thing that gets me excited, especially when I think of open data, and how we get to that path is GDP growth. And GDP growth happens by creating new roads that have painted lines, that have exits, but that also facilitate small businesses, which are the lifeblood of almost every country that we know of, facilitating faster payments, but also having better access to loans, better visibility to get loans, because like in Brazil alone, 30% more loans went out because they were able to de-risk small business because they were able to get a new insights they couldn't see without open banking.
Because they could see the data.
Yeah, and then their interest rates went down to small businesses by 2% because they were able to de-risk them and understand their cash flow infrastructure better. That's GDP growth. Like yeah. Canada's desperate for a GDP growth path. I know any country, but if we look at this as a GDP growth 2030 perspective to get to open data, that's a whole different discussion. We're not trying to curve off the growth of this. We're trying to find how do we get to the GDP part and where do SMEs win, and let's focus on them. Because if they win, then we could do all the cool stuff too. But we got to pick a path to a use case that's going to really drive growth.
Agree completely. New flavors of maple syrup just isn't going to cut it.
So agreed. And the nice thing about the us entrepreneurial folks here is in the States is we do look around the world from our friends in Britain, Australia, India, Brazil, who's done great work, but even Saudi and even South Korea and Singapore. And they've each had areas to learn from. And you're like, that's interesting. That works in this case. That might work here. And it gives us some guideline of things to try. And we're willing to try a lot of new things and experiment and grow. I think that's the beauty of it, how we've been able to do, and we've got like 700 data elements in FDX now. It's insane just how much people are like, hey, this would be great. And we do.
Digital wallets have recently taken center stage in the discussion surrounding open banking. There's about a half dozen competing standards out there. The EU is moving to create a unified one for the entire region. And notably, even the CFPB Section 1033 rule has included digital wallets in their scope. Where is the digital wallet space headed, and how does it fit into this open banking, open finance, open data puzzle?
I think actually that's one of the things where I've changed my mind a lot in the last. I think if we were having this discussion a year ago, we probably would have said, you know what, Apple and Google, their wallets are great. They own the market. Like, why would you think of doing it any other way? There's been a few things that have happened recently which have changed the thinking on this sort of thing. 1033 is one of them, opening up the data. One of the reasons I say that is because a wallet is a way of organizing identity. I mean, like, no one has money in their wallets. I mean, not in developed countries. A wallet is a place where you store identity, your cards. So the wallet is about... And that identity can come from a lot of different places. So the first thing is the wallet itself is becoming something much more important than just a place of payments. The second thing, and there's a technical issue, the technical thing is I think we didn't see Apple's move coming. We all thought that Apple would hold on to the closed secure element for a lot longer. I think that took a lot of people by surprise. And that gives other people the opportunity to put their wallets onto the phones and compete, not just for payments, but for travel and sorts of other things. And the third thing is, I think, and it's an observation I think a lot of people on the floor have made, is the things that Visa has been announcing around Visa Flex and shifting to credentials-based has also woken a lot of people up to the fact there's going to be competition in their wallet space now. So I think I've changed my mind. You know, a year ago, I probably would have said, I don't know, I can't really see past Apple and Google. I think now it looks a lot different.
Yeah, I can say I worked for a company, and back in 2015, we were shutting down a wallet that was created between a telco, ourselves, and a network. And it was too early. It was too early for the whole concept of wallets. People weren't there yet. Then you're right. Then it went really Samsung, Apple, Google concept. And you're talking about the NFS chip from an Apple perspective, like opening up their accessibility. You got to think like this is going to be the next ground that people are going to try and fight over, because it's the new top of wallet, right? You wanted to have your card as the top of wallet, the one they thought of, the one they wanted to pay with. Now you want to be the top of wallet in the sense of you need to have this
Well,
concept,
you don't
want
to be top of wallet. You want to be the wallet.
Well, yes, yeah, sorry. You want to be the wallet, not just top of wallet. Because before it was the concept of a physical opened wallet and you being the top card pulled. Now it's, yeah, you want to be that wallet that people think of when they double click on their phone. What are they pulling up? And how are they going to try and convince you to choose them? And are you going to have multiple wallets is the other question. But they're all going to have to go into 1033 open banking.
Well, and that's the beauty of common open standards. Any data provider, and that's why I harp on today about, it's not just about banks, it's other data providers can share data on a common format. And again, we don't compete on the USB end of the keyboard, we compete on the shiny, the gaming side of things. And so I think this will just make competition even more fierce, if you will. And I get competition's always benefits the consumer, and to the extent we're supportive of that, it's why we have wallet providers as some of our members, and we'll continue to serve the market.
Don, your thoughts on the inclusion of digital wallets in the scope of the regulation?
Okay, we're still reading through that. We'll go through that as time allows, with our whole membership. But again, anyone can use FTX, and we want everyone to use FTX.
Open banking is now active in over 70 countries around the world. When considered in the large, using the term that David used, digital public infrastructure, or DPI, who is going to lead, who is going to follow, and what will this all mean for global stability and peace?
How should I know? I'm a fintech guy. I don't know about world peace. Anyway, I don't care. I'm going to Mars with Elon Musk. I'm leaving you boat people to look after yourselves.
I told you to wash that bottle.
I think I don't have the answer other than the fact that when I look around the 70 countries in the world and I sit in Canada, largely jealous of every other country that has driven forth, we're still just, I think I describe Canada as our foot is on the starting line, but we haven't moved just yet. And when I look, I see Brazil as a shining light of how they implemented in a 12-month plan to open banking, followed by a 12-month plan to open finance, followed by Pix being massively successful, digital identity through their infrastructure being massively successful, and then their path to get insurance and wealth and everything into this game. And they were forceful, but yet they did it as an industry. And I think it was a kind of a beautiful madness to get to the infrastructure that they landed in. So they're my shining star with Australia's concept of CDR across five different industries. So continuing to an open data. I don't know how we can all visualize that, but I'm excited that 1033 dropped last week. Like, it has given me renewed sense of we are going forward.
Our friends in Ottawa remind us that slow and steady wins the race. So fear not. You get the learnings from everybody else who went before you, so that's not terrible. But you asked who would lead, and I would argue the customer has to lead, because you can't build solutions looking for problems. You have to instead find the problems, the pain points, and solve those. If you put the customer in charge, they'll tell you what to build. They vote with their thumbs now. I said that earlier, but it's absolutely true. And if you let the industry determine what goes next, they'll surprise you. We would have never thought about building a fraud endpoint or payroll or even tax forms. But once you said, well, what's going on through the firewall? Build that. That's what the customer wants. And so to your point, the idea of phones you could load across town to save your life as this personal security device, we've never thought about it, but it makes perfect sense. And so common tools, common standards, and ubiquity that work cross-border. I have family in Mexico, and remittances are still an issue. And so the ability to have common standards, do EKYC, so I can send TOTO some money because they need it and do it in a way that works, I think is incredibly useful.
Let's close with a prediction. The United States is special in a lot of ways. It's the world's largest economy, the largest banks, the most fintechs, and more existing data sharing than anywhere else. Now that regulated open banking is officially underway, is the U.S. going to surpass other regions in open banking maturity, or will it get stuck in the weeds?
I'm just going to predict and hope that we, like Brazil, drive forth with mission to get there, realizing we now have a path that has some clear direction that states that we can get to pay by bank, that we can figure out this path to let smaller institutions have more time and have this vision to drive out more competition. So that's my hope.
I think as an outsider, I think I'm allowed to say, I think there are some structural issues in the regulation of the US financial services sector, which I think are going to slow things down. You don't have the equivalent of payment institutions or electronic money institutions. There is no kind of federal fintech charter of any kind or whatever. So I think actually moving things through that morass of regulation is inevitably going to be slower. So I think things are going to work. I think in the US, it's maybe going to take longer than it took in other countries.
I would disagree in that we have this market-driven standard. I have 94 million users today using that. If I add up every other jurisdiction's open banking consumer count on the planet, for right now, globally, the US, through innovation alone, is bigger than the rest of the world combined.
Wonderful to end on an optimistic note. Thank you all for a great conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Given their sweeping and varied experience, it comes as little surprise that our three guests provide a whirlwind tour of all things open banking. From the UK's bold regulations focused on driving competition, to a uniquely American approach driven by the market, to the high-minded but exhausting ambitions of Canada, David, Don, and Michelle have seen open banking develop in substantially different ways. But for all of the differences, the core ideas and core challenges remain the same. How to move people from spenders to savers to investors. How to use digital infrastructure to help economies grow. How to enshrine data ownership and data rights. These are the questions that drive the open banking community all over the world. Our countries may be different. The way we view our banks may be different. How we view our governments may be different. But we all sense that there is a common flaw. Our banking systems are strangely out of step with how we live our modern lives. And our relationship to our data often feels outright wrong. As David says, open banking offers a new template, a new approach to banking, and a new approach to data. The beginning of a better way. As my fellow open banking champions know, the only way to get there is with a little help from your friends.
Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time.
This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.